Hi, my name's Russell Norman, and this is a podcast called Read Lots, Write Lots, a podcast for those who love to write. We have a great episode lined up in our writing tips segment. Deidre will be talking about variety, sentence type, sentence length, introductory elements, etc. But firstly, we're going to be talking with Lizzie Fuller. Lizzie Duffield Fuller writes a wide range of stories, with fantasy and short stories published under the name of E.M. Duffield Fuller, and historical romance novels under the pen name Beth Fuller. Her debut Victorian Gothic romance, The Heir of Drymon, which by the way I have just finished reading and thought was great, is being followed by two short novellas, The Blackbird, due out in October, and Charlotte's Surprise in December, all three of which are published by Divine Destinies. She has also written Felgrim, the first book of the Dark Watch trilogy, coming out in spring of 2022 with Heroic Books. However, not mentioned in her formal biography, but also written by Lizzie, is her contributions on Readsy in a series of short stories based in the fantasy world of Highmast, one of which is being turned into a podcast by Beth Connor over at Crossroads Cantina. When not writing, and who knows how she finds the time, Lizzie is studying for her PhD in Victorian literature at Aberystwyth University in Wales, where she lives with her husband and two young sons. Over to you, Deidre.
Thank you, Russell. Good morning, future Dr. Lizzie Duffield Fuller. We're so glad to have you and your many accomplishments. Most importantly, tell us about the two boys. Tell us what ages they are and if they've broken anything today.
My eldest is 5. He's called Ezra and he's just started year one. And my youngest is called Teddy and he's 13 months. And he's just learning to walk and he's very tall. So he's managing to grab everything off of every table and nowhere is safe anymore.
he's doing great. That's exactly what he should be doing. And your house won't be clean for another 20 years. So I'm just giving you a little shadowing. If you have a clean house, you're not parenting well. It should just be filthy at all times. Well, I'm so glad you're here. And again, it staggers me looking at your resume and your literary accomplishments, especially the wide range you have. Fantasy, yes, check. And the historical fiction, of course, just kind of exemplifies your level of schooling and your knowledge. You can't really understand or write decent historical fiction unless you have this great wellspring to draw from. I know you're working on your PhD in English, but do you have like a history background or is that just an interest?
No, it's not. I don't really have a history background. I didn't even do it for GCSE, actually. I wanted to, but the classes were full, so I didn't get to. But my PhD is in Victorian literature, which is the kind of era that I write for historical fiction too. So I thought it better come in handy for something.
Sure. And you pick up all the history by osmosis, I guess, by reading a lot of the classics there. And I have to ask you, who is it? I mean, I certainly am a fan of Charlotte Bronte. Who do you like? Of course, Jane Eyre. I'd like to be Jane Eyre, frankly. But who do you particularly enjoy?
I'm studying Dinah Craig, actually, for my PhD, and I find her really fascinating. But she was really famous at the time and hardly anyone has heard of her anymore, at least in the UK. I don't know what it's like with you.
You're asking an American about literary works? I go with the English there. So. Okay, tell us a little bit about her and what works are we missing from our canon?
The most famous ones you might have heard of are The Little Lame Prince and His Travelling Cloak, which was a children's story. And John Halifax Gentleman is also quite famous, or was quite famous at the time. And she really focused on writing disabilities in a way that other Victorian writers didn't, which I found really fascinating. A lot of her characters feature disabilities, but not in a way that quite often in Victorian fiction, they're presented quite sentimentally. So, you know, oh, look at this poor little match girl who's dying of consumption, that sort of thing. And she doesn't really do that. She had a lot of experience with people who were disabled in her life. So her husband lost his leg in a train accident, and he had to use prosthetics from then on. And her godson was blind and things like that. So she wrote characters that had quite realistic disabilities and things that added to their character without being their entire plot, which I think is really interesting.
It is, because like Dickens had Tiny Tim, and that was, you know, he was just one dimensional character. So her characters were round characters, and the disability wasn't just their defining characteristic. They're just complex. Wow. That's fascinating. And way ahead of her time. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. I want to ask you about your pseudonyms, because you write all this different stuff, the novels and the short stories and children's stories. And of course the short stories as well. I particularly like the Great Night Wolf. That one was, short and beautiful and just flow, action. And is it Savaga? Is that how you pronounce the name?
Yeah.
That's a Scandinavian, name. Wonderful.
I don't know if it's a real Scandinavian name. I was trying to get the vibe of it.
Oh, you made it up?
Yeah.
Oh,
no. It's supposed to be like a fantasy name with a kind of Scandinavian feel.
Yeah, no, I was like, I'm all in. But you used your full name. And then with your romances, it seems like you used Beth Fuller. For romances, and then
Elizabeth. So,
oh, okay, gotcha.
So Elizabeth. Yeah.
I mean, do you feel like with the pseudonyms, do you just kind of put on a different hat, like a different personality, to kind of get into the zone, or what are the what's the pseudonyms about? Why not just use the one name? Why do you kind of pick these pen names?
I think it's because I'm very aware that not everybody has such eclectic tastes and that people who want to find, for instance, my mother really enjoys the romance novels, but she hates all of the fantasy stuff. She's very supportive, but it's not her cup of tea at all. And so if she was looking at work, if she was a stranger to me and she was looking up other works that I'd written, and she was like, oh, yeah, I read her last book, I'm going to like this. And then she goes to something that's completely tonally different. I think that would be quite jarring.
Interesting, so I think about like J.K. Rowling with her pseudonym, Robert, was it Galbraith? And when she tried a whole different genre, which, had mixed reviews. And just I have to ask you a question. Someone was telling me that Harry Potter can be classified as Victorian Gothic. Do you agree or disagree with that? I was a little surprised at that comment, but would you classify that with the different tropes and archetypes? Yeah, I know, right? That's exactly what I kind of went, huh, let me think about that for a bit. And also the idea of Harry Potter being a feminine hero, and how the attributes, the idea of that. That was just a question I had in passing. But back to the pseudonyms, I have a couple as well. And I find when I write, my personality definitely changes. There's one pseudonym I use just for kind of more satirical, it's a little bitter, so, and then I have one that's with a romance, and the name kind of follows suit. So it always kind of interests me about pen names. But let's take you back when you were younger. Obviously, you fell in love with books, I would imagine, as a young child. And who did you read? Who really influenced you?
I think I had a lot of support, really, when I was growing up. My mum's a teacher, so she taught me and my brother to read very young. And she always encouraged us to read and write. And she would always buy us books. Like, if we wanted a storybook, she would buy it for us. And she'd take us to the library in the holidays. And she was very focused on teaching us, to read and write and to learn those skills. But I think it was my father who really instilled the love of fantasy in me. So he actually was the one who taught me to touch type so that I could write up stories on our old computer. And I think that was because he got bored of having to write them out when I was dictating them. He also was the one who got me onto the Discworld series when I was a teenager. And he let me steal all his old books that he had in the series. And he would buy me others for Christmas when they would come up. And one of my first memories, actually, one of a really important memory when I was a kid, I just have this really vivid memory of him sitting on the landing hall, my father, and my brother and I were both in bed, and we'd have the bedroom doors open so that he could read The Hobbit to us as our bedtime story and do it both at the same time.
In one night, he read you The Hobbit? That was a long night. That's amazing. And so, I mean, did you write as a young adolescent or child as well? Did he encourage you to write?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wrote loads of stories all the time, and my poor parents had to listen to them all. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember when I was about 6 or 7, I used to write these stories about orphans who lived in a shed at the bottom of the garden, and, you know, these people who got sucked through the stomach of a snowman and stuck in a desert island inside the snowman, and just nonsense.
I think Frozen 3 would you may want to talk to Disney about that. That might work. Olaf, and I think there's some plush animal toys that can be sold that way. Very good. So with fantasy, what's the challenge of writing fantasy? Because it's so hard to do well. I have a dear friend who writes fantasy, and I've read some of his stuff, and it ranges from interesting to just horrible. You know, I think it's challenging to not make it sound so silly or sophomoric or cliche. How, you know, and I guess we can talk about Remnant. You know, that's on Amazon. And I mean, would you classify that as fantasy?
Yeah, I would call it fantasy. Yeah. Why would it not be fantasy? Because it doesn't have so much magic in it.
Well, no, I thought that was that the goal, or I to me, there's a lot of like, it seems to be a very rich in the history, and I don't know, how much of that is just kind of from your memories or from your culture, or, you know, how much is just pure made up? Is it just kind of all fused together?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it definitely comes from a lot of different sources. I wrote Remnant after my first son was born. So about 5 years ago now. And we had just left Trauskoid, which is just down the road from where we were living. And we had this kind of poor but idyllic lifestyle where we lived opposite this woods, and there was this big stream that ran through the woods. And we used to go walking around the woods all the time with a stream. And we had to leave at the end of the year when the baby was coming, because my husband's job came down to London. And I think that a lot of the way that Remnant was formed was a kind of a love letter to the home that I was leaving behind, really. And so a lot of the landscape in the story comes from the places that I was living in at the time. And a lot of the kind of backstory comes from the kind of Welsh folkloric traditions. A lot of the kind of King Arthur stuff comes through it, the kind of twisted. And I think there's a lot of kind of the emotional weight of being an English person in Wales comes through in that story, about how much is colonialism and how much is integration. But I think at its heart, it is a fantasy story. It's not in any way meant to be historical. It's supposed to be a kind of a merging of all these influences from where I was in my life at that point, I think.
Right. And certainly the birth of your first child, I'm sure, was incredibly profound. And I love the Celtic references, you know, the threefold sacrifice, you know, because the Druids are the threefold death, and how that kind of evolved to the being hanged, drawn, and quartered. And it just seemed to be rich with so much. And that's a question I want to talk to you about with regards to some of your themes, you know, the idea of just this richness of the human condition. You reminded me of an author named Paul Kalanithi, and he wrote an autobiography. He was a well-renowned neurosurgeon, but he also wanted to know about life, and how he felt that really literature was the way to kind of learn through that. So along with his medical degree at Yale, he got his BA and his master's in English literature, but also in philosophy. And he could kind of relate to patients from just like the physical aspect, but also like this more deeper level because of his knowledge of literature and philosophy. And he said at one point, "I was driven less by achievement than by trying to understand. in earnest. What makes human life meaningful? I still felt literature provided the best account of the life of the mind, while neuroscience laid down the most elegant rules of the brain. And he, you know, says in his autobiography that midway through, he has headaches and he's in his late 30s and he takes a brain scan. And as a doctor, he reads it and realizes that his end is near, that he has an inoperable brain tumor. And so, you know, I'm jealous of your ability to go and work on your PhD in literature and do this deep dive. But how has that helped you become a better writer in studying the works of others? And, you know, in your own life, you know, what have you kind of gleaned from the literature you've been immersed in recently?
I think one of the most profound ways it's impacted my writing is going in with a more conscious, aware of themes. Like you go in thinking, I think when I was younger, I would just write whatever I was thinking, more or less. And it would kind of be a snapshot of where I was at that time. Whereas now when you go in, you try and think, okay, what are the themes of this novel? And you try and weave them through, you know, all the way through. And I think that part of that has come from being trained to look for themes in other people's work.
So you're weaving a tapestry like tighter and more, you know, more beautiful by just, yeah, fantastic. So what you've had all these works of in different forms. Have you ever missed a character? Like you want to go back and revisit a character? Who's a crush that you've conjured up out of thin air?
I think I don't foresee it happening anytime in the near future, but I would like to revisit Remnant again, because I don't think that I did it as well as I could have done. I think if I wrote it again now, I would write it differently. And I think that I would eventually like to revisit it. But those characters did speak to me and they were important to me. And so I would like to do them justice, I think. I think especially—
Maybe a screenplay, like a different form, or just like redo the novel? Because I mean, Netflix—
Well, originally—
At some point, everybody in the world will have to write something for Netflix because, you know, we're kind of churning through a lot of material. Have you considered turning some of your work into a screenplay for a TV or a movie?
It's not something I have really considered. No, not yet.
Might as well. You're that's the only form you haven't. Maybe a poem. You know, so you can write some epic poetry to kind of round out all of your different ones. All right. Do you have something coming? What are you conjuring up now? What's kind of on the back burner or the front burner?
Well, I'm working on a couple more seasonal shorts for my romance novels. And I like them because they're very quick, so you can fit them in around other projects. And I'm trying to work on Prowler, which is the sequel to Felgrim, but that's still in the first draft stages at the moment. And then I'm trying not to work on The Mudbourne Twins, which is this project I really want to get my teeth into. And I've got lots of brilliant ideas for it. Well, I hope they're brilliant, but I've got lots of ideas for it. I really want to write it, but I promised myself that I wouldn't start any more projects until the first draft of Prowler had been finished. So I'm desperately trying to keep that promise. But I occasionally I'm like scribble down notes in my notebook just because I don't want to forget them.
Well, and writers out there that are trying to find time to squeeze into their schedule, what works for you? Are you like a late night person, or is it like, you know, do you have a schedule where you sneak away and someone helps pick up the slack? How do you fit that in?
Mostly at the moment, I do it during nap times. So I drop my son off to school and then my youngest has a morning nap and I do a bit of writing then. And then when I get my biggest home from school, the little one has another nap, so I managed to get a bit more done then before dinner. And then a couple of hours before bed, do a bit of writing as well. And then sometimes on the weekend, my husband will take the boys to the playground so I can have a whole morning just to write, which is really nice.
It'd be nice to just have a whole morning to yourself to do anything. So busy household. So what's the last time that you surprised yourself? Like you wrote something down and you were like, oh my gosh, that's good. You know, you wrote something down that was profound and you didn't really know that you felt that way. And you kind of surprised yourself.
I don't think I ever really feel like that when I'm writing. I think when I'm in the midst of it, I'm always feeling like, is this any good? Is this worth anything? And especially when you're editing, I think one of the hardest things is it doesn't look like a book, especially if you edit it with track changes on. Everything comes out in red, and then by the end of it, more of the book is red than black. And it never feels like a book. It never feels professional. I think the moment that I have, when I think, oh, actually, this did kind of work, is when you go back later and you've got some emotional distance from it and you see it in a format that is either properly printed or it's on an online journal and you see it for itself and you see it as a reader rather than as a writer. And I think that's the moment that you can approach it more objectively.
Do you have a copy writer or an editor, or do you do all yourself?
Well, my husband is my beta reader, so I make him read everything after I after I finish the draft. But then the editors come from the companies. Yeah. So with Divine Destinies, I'm with Catherine Chisnell. She's my editor, and she is fantastic. She's really warm and encouraging and supportive, and she was wonderful. And with Heroic Books, I was with Fred Johnson, who was slightly less cuddly, but he was amazing. Like, he knew what he was talking about. So even though you were crying when you were reading his notes, the book that came out at the end of it was worth it.
And how did you get on the radar screen? How are they discovering you? How'd you punch through the clutter? Was it a contest, or you just, friends of friends, or you did a query letter? How did you make it to these guys?
I just queried them. Yeah. I originally sent Air of Dry Moat to Harlequin because they take unagented submissions, and I knew that. And they obviously rejected it. And I was feeling quite down about that. And Pete's my husband, he said, look, there must be other companies that don't require an agent. I hadn't really heard of any. So I did a bit of research and I kind of just Googled, small press publishers that don't require agents, and wrote down everything that came up and then worked my way down the list effectively. So
it sounds methodical. Yeah, you had a plan. you do well running a small country. So you didn't, have you entered a lot of contests, or are you just more about the product and getting that to agents or to publishing houses?
I do occasionally enter contests, but mostly I just stick to getting it out there, really.
Yeah, everybody has their process, I suppose. And trying to find the time to write, you are definitely a fantasy character trying to conjure up 30 hours in the day in raising two young boys. Russell, you have any questions for our wonderful guest here?
Oh, I absolutely do. Thanks, Lizzie, for coming in and joining us. My first question is, what do you think makes for good writing? I mean, obviously you write lots of different things. What makes for good writing? What do you think is a good write? It wasn't supposed to be a trick question.
I know. I've put on the spot now. I can't think. I don't know. I suppose it's something that you can empathise with, mostly. Like, it doesn't have to be a character that you've been in the same position with, or someone that you can see yourself in, but it has to be someone that you can understand. And even when they make stupid decisions and you think, why are you doing that? You can see why they are doing it, even if it's not why you would do it. And I think if you can capture that in a character, then you know that you've written something good.
Right. And the converse question is, what do you think makes bad writing? What do you read and go, oh my God, this is terrible? Which is probably a harder question to ask, because people don't want to, dumpster on people's stuff. But what's for bad writing? What do you hate when you read something?
I think there are some things that feel a bit clunky when they're written. Maybe they're a bit over-explained, like their body language of the character hints at how they're feeling, and then they tell you how they're feeling in the next line. And you think, I got that. You need to trust your reader a little bit more, I think.
Deidre's giving me a big thumbs up now, because in fact we did that on a little podcast a couple of episodes ago, didn't we? Not Deidre said, show not tell. That's a big mantra of Deidre's. So yeah, good one.
Yeah, let give your reader the chance to connect the dots. Mm. Let them figure it out. That's the big aha. And I 100% agree with you. The connection is everything. I teach 12th graders, and really having them connect with anything at this point is a miracle. And we started Hamlet. And of course, I think anyone who knows me knows that I'm a huge fan. And just that whole, scene one, act two, where he's there with his mother, with her new step-husband, and all that family drama played out in front of the court. They get it. They understand why 400 years later, you know, just being completely embarrassed by your family and having some complicated relationship and just wanting to go off to college and party and just, you know, and leave it all behind and being dragged back, they relate. And I think you're right. We're so ready for connection. C.S. Lewis said, you know, we read to know that we're not alone. And I told these kids, I said, any weird thought you've ever had, you know, flit across your mind is a human condition. People have been thinking those same thoughts for thousands of years. So, Lizzie, it must break your heart when, you know, almost like history teachers, when you see in society things that could be cured with a book, you know? Mm. I do you feel that way? Do you feel like we'd have a whole lot more social, emotional stability if people just remember to read and to live vicariously through these characters?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there's become a bit of a trend in reading where people feel like you have to be able to endorse the protagonist, and that if a protagonist does something that is questionable, it means that the author believes questionable things. And I think that we need to not only read more, we need to be able to read critically and to be able to see, what is this book teaching us? Not just, do I like the character? Do I agree with what they're doing?
Yeah, that's interesting with all the anti-heroes, you know, that as long as they're funny and cool, that's good. You know, I think heroes per se, you know, embody the cultural values of a society. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about your side of the pond there, but we have fully embraced the anti-hero. And so, again, you know, being a bad boy is the way to go, you know. Mm. And it's interesting to see the big shift. So Russell, what else?
Well, I was just going to ask one more thing, because, in fact, I sent on that series that you wrote on Reedsy, the HIMARS series, I generated a little map myself because I wanted to get my sort of head around the whole layout of the land sort of stuff. So I'm just interested to know, when other people like my good self put a map together and sent it to you, and how you feel about people taking your works and adding something to it, changing it a bit. Does it get you nervous? Does it get you annoyed by it because you're taking someone else's ideas? And what's your sort of take? You know, we talked about writing a script for Netflix. I'm sure some producer's going to ruin it because they're going to change it how you want it. How do you feel about somebody else taking your stuff and running with it and changing it?
No, I think it's amazing. Honestly, I didn't stop smiling all day. I showed that map to everybody. I honestly did. I think, honestly, it's
You didn't need to like it, by the way. You didn't need to. That was. I'm just sort of interested in how fun, because I did it, and I thought, I wonder what this author's going to think of mucking with her stuff, you know? So that's the point, thing, you know, of any author, you know?
No, definitely. I think that, I mean, you've got the whole death of the author once it's out of your hands, you know, it's theirs to do with what they wish. You have to let go of your projects once they're done. But the idea that anybody just wants to embody your work in the way that I wanted to embody work, other people's work when I was a child, and that, you know, I wanted to be a witch with Mildred Hubble, and I wanted to go to Narnia, and I used to write little stories about, you know, me getting into Narnia and going off with the Pevensies and that kind of fan fiction stuff, I suppose. And the idea that other people have been infused by your work to such a degree that they want to make it their own, I think that's just the best thing that can happen to any author, really.
Excellent. It's very flattering.
Yeah.
We were reading about an author who said that, you know, in their work, they leave fingerprints, but it's also a Rorschach test for the reader. So when it works, you know, you see, you know, it's hard to get the author completely off the page. I think there's room for a little biographical criticism. But the idea where you have, you know, you could read a text, and one that's stood the test of time for sure, and how the reader can completely personify it and take it to themselves. The fact that, you know, you inspired Russell to hammer out a Tolkien, I mean, your dad would have been proud of The Hobbit there with the maps.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, when you write your these complicated stories, do you kind of have like a little map in your mind? Do you kind of like, you know, parse it out, or are you just going to have the characters take you on a ride?
Oh, no, I draw everything out. Because I can't, it sounds stupid, but I can't always think inside my head. Like, I need to be able to see things. So for Felgrim, for instance, the characters, it follows lots of different storylines at the same time. And the characters are in different places of the country and they travel around the country. And so I needed to make sure, for in my first draft, for instance, Marla, one of the characters, takes 4 days to go up the country and only 2 days to come back. So I needed to work that out. And I can't do that unless I can see it and unless I can plot it out. So I draw everything out.
That's quite a process. I usually let let my characters just fall into the ditch and see where they go. But yeah, that's their process. Thank you, future Dr. Duffield Fuller. We appreciate you coming on, Lizzie. Look forward to seeing all the many things you conjure up there and your moments of peace. And best of you to your husband, who is so supportive. Way to go, guy. Way to go, Peter, right?
Peter, yeah.
Good job, Peter. And then those lovely boys. Thanks for coming by. We'll see you on the boards and definitely in the bookstores.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie, for coming in and having a chat. In our next segment, Deirdre dips into her very large writing tips jar and pulls out some little gem that you may find useful in your writing. In this episode, she's going to be talking about the secret to good writing is variety. Sentence type, sentence length, introductory elements, etc.
Russell, how's it going? Yes, I'm reading a whole bunch of student essays and boy, are they tedious. And I tell the kids, and they'll get it at some point maybe, about how they have to vary really everything. Their diction. If they're going to write a short story, you can't say he says, she says, they say. Yeah, over and over again. Instead of said, you can use muttered or mumbled or whispered. So, you know, even the diction we use in very common things like walking, there's a bunch of other verbs to kind of amp that up, you know, scurried, strutted, right? So just variety really picks up this of the pace. But I think people understand that about word choice and diction and vocabulary. But even the sentence length, the sentence type, if it's short sentence, it's fantastic. You get a little punch to it. And if it's very long and ruminating, there's a place for that too, but not too much of either. You really want to kind of spice it up and kind of interchange it. Listen to this one paragraph I read to the kids. This sentence has 5 words. Here are 5 more words. 5-word sentences are fine, but several together become monotonous. Listen to what is happening. The writing is getting boring. The sound of it drones. It's like a stuck record. The ear demands some variety. And that kind of proves my point. If you have just simple sentences or even compound sentences, it gets really, really dry. Now listen. I vary the sentence length and I create music. Music. The writing sings. It has a pleasant rhythm, a lilt, a harmony. I use short sentences and I use sentences of medium length. And sometimes when I am certain the reader is rested, I will engage him with a sentence of considerable length, a sentence that burns with energy and builds with all the impetus of a crescendo, of the roll of drums, the crash of the cymbals, sounds that say, listen to this, it is important. So write with a combination of short, medium, and long sentences. Create a sound that pleases the ear. Don't just write words, write music. And that's kind of how it should go. The sentence type, we should have, use simple sentences, but also compound and compound complex. Use your different sentence types, the declarative or the interrogative or the imperative or the exclamatory. They're all there. They're all tools in your toolbox. And like a good artist, just paint with all the colors. Thanks, Russell. We'll see you next week.
Sadly, that's all we have time for in this episode. We would again like to thank Lizzie Fuller for coming on our podcast and providing some wonderful insights into her journey as a writer. Coming up in the next episode, we'll be talking to Robert Jensen, a published writer and author of a number of books. Also coming up next episode, Deirdre will be reaching into the writing tips jar for another handy morsel to help us on our many paths of our writing travels. But before we go, I'd just like to mention, if you are a writer and would like to come and have a chat with us on a future episode and talk about your writing challenges, promote your writing, or just have a chat about life, we'd love to hear from you. You can get in contact with us at our website, readlotswritelots.com. Well, that's it for this episode. So on behalf of Deirdre and myself and the entire team here at readlotswritelots.com, until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.